If you'd like to take the purple Mark's Gospels from in front of you and turn to page 45, we're going to be reading from chapter 15, verse 33, and that can be found on page 45. So starting to read at verse 33. And when the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani," which means, "My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?" And some of the bystanders hearing it said, "Behold, he is calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled a sponge with sour wine, put it on a reed, and gave it to him to drink, saying, "Wait, let us see whether Elijah will come to take him down." And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last. And the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion, who stood facing him, saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, "Truly this man was the Son of God."
John, I thank you very much indeed for reading for us. May I welcome you again to the third week of our five-week Christianity Explored course. We've been doing exactly what the course says. We've been exploring the Christian faith. And in week one, we had a look at the question, who was Jesus? And we saw his claim to be God. And we saw Jesus' claim confirmed by the authority of his teaching and the authority of his life. Authority over evil, over sickness, over nature, over death, and over sin. Last week we asked the question then, why did Jesus come? And we saw that Jesus came to rescue rebels. All of us have rebelled against God. We looked at that. The evidence, I hope, was very plain for all of us to see, and it was certainly plain for me. And we saw the danger that we are in, because God will not allow rebels to continue in their rebellion unchecked. That has to be right, if God is God. This week we're going to be looking at the death of Jesus, and we're going to seek to answer the question, why then did Jesus die? And when you stop and think about it, the death of Jesus does appear at first to be totally nonsensical. This man, who we claim is nothing less than God himself, reaching his end on a cross, seems absurd. You only have to have seen the trailer for Mel Gibson's film, The Passion, to realize how gruesome crucifixion was. The Roman writer, politician, philosopher Cicero said of the cross, the executioner, the veil that covered the condemned man's head, the cross of crucifixion, these are horrors which ought to be far removed, not only from the person of a Roman citizen, but even from his thoughts and gaze and his hearing. It is utterly wrong that a Roman citizen, a free man, would ever be compelled to endure or tolerate such dreadful things. But death on a cross was not only gruesome, it was also the most shameful form of execution available at the time. Crucifixion was reserved only for the most despised criminal. So shameful was it that one piece of ancient Roman graffiti found on a wall in a schoolroom in the second century carries the picture of a cross with a man stretched out on the cross with the head of a donkey, and then the caption, "Alexamenos worships his God." To worship a crucified man? How shameful. The Jews considered a crucified man to be absolutely under the curse of God. The Muslims so despised the idea of Jesus on a cross that when the Quran was written, hundreds of years obviously after the death of Jesus, the Quran insists that Jesus didn't actually die on a cross. So Jesus' death is ghastly, gruesome. Jesus' death is shameful. One other thing. Jesus' death appears to be the most awful tragedy. I was teaching this course about 14 years ago now I think about it, back in the early 1990s, down in South London. And I can never forget the man who was sitting there somewhere in the back row on the first week of the course when we looked at who was Jesus. Jesus was God. He was an old guy. I guess he was in his 60s. And he was from Yorkshire. And as we went through the claims of Jesus and the evidence to support his claims, he was heckling from the back right the way through. Jesus claims to be absolute rubbish. You can't believe that sort of rot. Jesus, you can't believe that sort of thing nowadays, and so on. So I fully expected not to see him back on week two. We used to look at the cross on week two in those days. And then week two, we began with a description of the crucifixion. Extraordinarily, there was Jim right in the front row. And when we'd finished the description of the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, the voice popped out, "What a tragedy." So gruesome, shameful, tragic, yes, that this beautiful life, the most beautiful life ever lived, should end on a cross. And yet Christians everywhere are in some way proud of the cross. Find a genuine Christian, and you will find somebody who boasts in the cross. Someone who won't stop talking about the cross. Go up on the London Eye, if you can stand the heights, and when you get to the top, look down on top of St. Paul's Cathedral, and you will see the building is in the shape of a cross. Strikingly, the last third of each of the Gospels is taken up with an explanation of the cross. Extraordinary, isn't it, for a biography? One third of the book taken up with the death. Even more compelling, I think, is that Jesus himself knew he was going to die on a cross, and right the way through his life seems deliberately, from a certain point, to be heading towards his death. Just turn to page 23 on these purple books you've got, and gospel accounts you've got there. It's chapter 8, verse 31, page 23, I mean. Sorry, not 33, page 23. And you will see there, Jesus foretells his death and resurrection, verse 31. "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man," that's another word for Jesus, "must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again." He said this plainly. Turn over a couple of pages. Page 26, chapter 9, verse 30. "They went on from there and passed through Galilee, and he didn't want anyone to know, for he was teaching his disciples, saying to them, 'The Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise.'" Over the page, page 29, central paragraph, Jesus foretells his death a third time, verse 32, towards the bottom of the verse. "And taking the 12 again, he began to tell them what was to happen to him, saying, 'See, we're going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered over to the chief priests and the scribes. They will condemn him to death and deliver him over to the Gentiles. They'll mock him, spit on him, flog him, and kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise.'" Turn over the page. You find it there again. Page 30, verse 45, top paragraph. "Even the Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." So why did Jesus die? Tragedy can't be the right word for it. What I want to do over the next few minutes is to go to the account of the death of Jesus in chapter 15, and I want us to see that far from being a tragic, shameful, and gruesome thing, though they are those things, there is a purpose to the death of Jesus, and it is actually the most wonderful and glorious turning point of human history. So first, chapter 15, page 45, and verse 33, the death of Jesus. And the first point is this: at the cross, God was angry. Verse 33, "When the sixth hour had come, there was darkness over the whole land until the ninth hour." Now, Mark is counting the hours according to the Jewish system here, so the sixth hour would have been midday. Therefore, at the moment when the midday sun should have been at its brightest, a darkness fell over the whole land and remained there until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It couldn't have been an eclipse, because Passovers always fall on a full moon, and eclipses don't happen at a full moon. Anyway, solar eclipses tend to last, I'm told, about 6 minutes. That's my memory on the beach in Italy when it last happened. It's rather inconvenient, actually. I'm told that solar eclipses last about 6 minutes. This lasted for 3 hours. Something supernatural is going on here. And time again in the Bible, darkness symbolizes the anger, the judgment, the displeasure of God. Go to the prophet Isaiah, look at chapter 8, and you will see that Isaiah is speaking there about a land in darkness, symbolizing God's judgment. So when darkness comes over the land at the death of Jesus, it is an indication of the anger of God. We saw last week that God simply has to express anger at human rebellion and sin. He has to punish evil. For God to leave human rebellion unpunished would mean that God is not concerned with human rebellion. Now, you saw the pictures of on Monday, Tuesday morning, of Chelsea O'Mahony, sentenced to 8 years for her part in the happy slapping so-called incident. Imagine for a moment that she was found guilty, which she was, and then the judge just folded his arms, smiled at her and said, "Well, Chelsea, you look like a reasonable sort of person. Just don't do it again." I mean, it would be an absolute outrage, a judicial outrage, a travesty of justice. Imagine if those boys really are guilty of Damilola Taylor's murder, and they are found guilty beyond doubt, and the judge just puts his hands together and says, "Well, never mind. Just don't do it again." It would mean that our whole legal system is utterly corrupt. So God has to be angry at sin and human rebellion. That has to be so. Otherwise, you would be worshipping the most gruesome ogre imaginable. The extraordinary thing here, though, is that it appears that God is angry at Jesus. God the Father, angry at God the Son. And we've already seen Jesus has never committed any sin. So what's going on? First, at the cross, God is angry. Second, at the cross, Jesus is abandoned. And I want us now to look at what is known as the cry of desolation that you'll see there in verse 34. Next verse there on page 45, the death of Jesus, verse 34. "And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, 'Eloi, Eloi, lema sabachthani,' which means, 'My God, my God, why have you forsaken me?'" I have to confess, for years, I always thought that that cry, I don't know about you, was what you thought, but I've always thought that cry was Jesus crying out at the agony. It wasn't until I became a Christian and somebody explained this to me that it's not so much a cry about the physical suffering so much as the spiritual desertion. And you can see that from the translation, can't you, of the Aramaic. My God, why have you forsaken me?" In other words, the issue is God-forsakenness. At the cross, God the Son was suffering the spiritual desertion of God the Father. As he carries in his body all of God's just judgment and right anger at the rebellion of humanity, yours and mine, God the Son, for the first time in eternity, experiences the displeasure of God the Father. We saw just now, didn't we, that for you and me to be forgiven, God can't simply, justly, sweep our rebellion under the carpet and say, "Well, never mind, it doesn't matter. That will be a travesty of justice." No, God simply has to execute his justice. Otherwise, God would not be just. Well, as Jesus hangs on the cross, he is carrying in his body, on the tree, the pure and just and perfect judgment of our Creator at everything you and I have ever done wrong. Now, I think it's important we realise that this just isn't sort of one little idea that comes out of the blue. Elsewhere in Mark's Gospel, Jesus refers to himself as a servant. We read the verse, one of the verses, actually, where Jesus refers to himself as a servant. The Son of Man came as a ransom, not to be served, but to serve. And that idea of God's suffering servant is a big Bible idea that was around for hundreds of years before the birth of Jesus. And what I've done under point two there on the back of the notice sheet is to copy down, or have copied down for us, the passage which most explicitly refers to the suffering servant. And therefore I want to read Isaiah chapter 53, verses 4 to 6. Surely he, that is the suffering servant, has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we considered him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. Transgressions is when we deliberately wander from God. He was crushed for our iniquities. Iniquities is when we fall short of God's perfect standard. Upon him, the suffering servant, was the chastisement that brought us peace. And by his stripes we are healed. Now, do you see the language of substitution? He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. With his stripes we are healed. So that on the cross, God the Son, in full agreement with God the Father, was stepping into your place and to mine, carrying in his body on the tree all of God's anger and judgment at everything you and I have ever done wrong. Now, if you'll forgive me, I'm going to use an illustration now, which you may feel is rather patronizing, and I hope you'll forgive me for using it. Really, I only had the cross explained to me for the first time when I was about 19 and a half, something like that, a little while ago now. And it was this illustration that helped me to make sense of it more than any others. It's not perfect, but it really did help. The speaker, who was speaking actually to teenage children, and I happened to be sitting at the back listening, and he said this. He said, let this hand represent you and me. And let this, when I say CD, well, we didn't have a disc and have CDs. He said book. But last week we were talking about having a DVD of our life's activities and how we would know that we'd rebelled against God if it was shown up on the wall here. Let this DVD represent your rebellion and mine. And let that light up there represent God. Now look down at verse 6 of Isaiah 53 that you'll see there on the sheet. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. Now you have to be extraordinarily arrogant to hold out that you've never rebelled against God, your creator. If that's your view of yourself, then I'm afraid there's nothing I can do to help you or Jesus. All we like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. But the Lord, that's God in heaven, has laid on him, that's the suffering servant, Jesus Christ, the iniquity of us all. And the speaker said, well then, where is your rebellion, your sin and mine? Why, it's on Jesus Christ. That's why he cries out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because he's carrying there the sin of the whole world. Where does that leave you and me? If we turn to Jesus and recognize his rightful rule and come to him in submission, why, it leaves us able and free from our sin. You may say to me, well, how is that ever just? I mean, surely that's just an innocent third party being punished for somebody else's wrong. Well, it's just from God's point of view, because Jesus is fully God. And your rebellion and mine is against God, and therefore he is the one to whom judgment is due. So that on the cross, God the Father and God the Son find a way within themselves, if you like, for the right and just anger to be expressed. It's just from a human point of view, because Jesus is fully man. And as a perfect human being, he had no sin of his own, no rebellion of his own, and therefore he can step in your place and mine. That means that if you and I were to turn back to God in recognition that we've gone wrong, and in recognition of the right, loving rule of Jesus, then we can be accepted. And that takes us to the last point, and you'll see it there in verse 37, the final verse that we're going to look at now, verse 37. And Jesus uttered a loud cry and breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Now, it's important to realize that the curtain in the temple wasn't a kind of Laura Ashley window covering. Nothing small and dainty like that. Listen to Alfred Edersheim as he describes the curtain in the temple. The veils before the most holy place were 60 feet long and 30 wide, the thickness of the palm of the hand, wrought in 72 squares which were joined together. They were so heavy that in the exaggerated language of the time, it needed 300 priests to manipulate each. So imagine a vast, great kind of tapestry thing, the thickness of a hand, hanging up in front of the most holy place, which symbolized the presence of God. Of course you and I can't go in there because of our rebellion. Rebellion has to be dealt with, punished. We're shut out, rightly so. But on the day that Jesus died on the cross, that great veil that symbolized a huge, great no-entry sign was torn from top to bottom. Not from bottom to top. A human might have done that. It was torn from top to bottom. The remarkable truth is that on the cross, God is making a way whereby you and I can have a restored relationship with him if we will come to Jesus and submit to him. Well, I wonder how you respond to that. It's interesting, in this last, when you look, do your home study, you'll notice this. In this penultimate chapter of Mark's Gospel, there are three or four different responses. There are the soldiers. We come across them in verse 16. They nail the nails in. They're all in a day's work. And then they crack on to the next thing. Perhaps it was square bashing that afternoon. They do the crucifixion. I have no doubt they did it well. And then they're on to something else. Now, there'll be plenty of people here in the city like that. The crucifixion of Jesus? Oh, yeah, yeah, the crucifixion of Jesus, it happened, yeah, and then I'm busy paying my mortgage, doing the job. Then there are the religious leaders. They walk past Jesus, and they say of Jesus, well, he said he could save others, why doesn't he save himself? And there are religious leaders like that all over the place. So convinced of their own religious opinion that it's as if their fingers are in their ears. They don't want to hear about this Jesus. All of us will have bumped into people like that. Then there's Pilate. Verse 15. Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released Barabbas and delivered Jesus to be crucified. Well, he's a man pleaser, isn't he? Pilate. All he's interested in is the vote. What the populace think. So he's not concerned at finding out what the cross is all about, so frightened of what other people would think that he will not side with Jesus. There are all sorts of different people. And then there's the centurion in verse 39. When the centurion who stood facing him saw that in this way he breathed his last, he said, truly, this man was the Son of God. Well, I'm going to stop there, and we've got, I guess, 10 minutes or so. It'd be lovely to continue to discuss what we've been thinking about. There are a number of different responses to Jesus. I've had them printed out there for us. The busy soldier, the religious leader, the cowardly pilot, the detached bystander who's interested, and then off onto the next thing, and the Roman centurion. I wonder, my question to you, you've got plenty of chance to ask me questions on the email, my question to you around the tables would be, Which of the different responses to Jesus do you most associate with? Which of these different responses to Jesus' death do you most associate with?